From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Do you recognize this voice?
And then after that, he got hired by Disney to restart the Mouseketeers.
Around 700,000 of you download his podcast each week, making it one of the most popular in the country. It's This American Life host and executive producer Ira Glass, talking about the man Glass thanks for starting the genre that became This American Life. We'll meet Ira Glass today in advance of his visit next month to Fort Myers with his one-man show. Plus, as today marks National Tourism Day, we take a look at the status of the state's largest industry in Southwest Florida. As spring break season continues, we examine industry projections for the year, strategies for attracting visitors, and find out what tourism officials look for from this year's legislative session. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Amy Tardiff. Coming up in half an hour, a record-breaking tourist season. But first, This American Life host and executive producer Ira Glass joins us today to talk about his life, his work, and his visit to Fort Myers next month with his one-man show. Glass's philosophy includes having fun no matter what line of work you're in.
The more that you're out to amuse yourself, the more memorable the work will be.
According to its website, the weekly public radio show This American Life is broadcast on more than 500 stations, including WGCU, to about 1.8 million listeners across the nation. Produced by Chicago Public Media and distributed by Public Radio International, it's also often the most popular podcast in the country, with around 700,000 people downloading it each week. It was a Showtime television version for 2 years, winning 3 Emmys. Various stories from the radio show are being or have been developed into films. Though the show is produced in Chicago, Glass now lives in hip New York City. He entered public radio as a teenager, and now his unique method of storytelling is credited with helping introduce the medium to younger audiences. He'll be at the Barbara B. Mann Performing Arts Hall in Fort Myers at 7 p.m. on April 14th. Ira Glass, what happens in your one-man show?
What happens in the one-man show is I stand on stage, I have an iPad with sound clips and music and stuff, and I can recreate the sound of our radio show just kind of as I talk. And I talk about the radio show and why we're making a radio show, I and the staff, that's so different from most radio shows or TV shows. And then I talk about how we do it, and all of that is kind of an excuse to just play very favorite bits from old shows and funny bits and emotional bits.
Did you always tell your news stories in your This American Life style, or do you remember how that transition began?
Oh, I remember very well. I had an unusual situation where I started working at NPR in Washington when I was 19 as an intern, and then got hired as a production assistant when I was 20 by a guy whose job was to invent new ways to do documentaries. At NPR, and he worked for, this is the 1970s, the late 70s. He ran a series called Options, which is the most like 1970s public broadcasting title. And he just taught me a lot of ways to think about how to make a radio story that were different from what was happening on the news shows then. And a lot of things he did became kind of mainstream practices in public radio all over the country, like using sound and having characters in stories sometimes narrate the stories. But also he would use music in the way that we use music on the radio show today, and things like that. So a lot of things I learned from him. And then I left him or just started to work also with the staff of All Things Considered. When I was 20, I started as a staffer on NPR's daily news show, All Things Considered, out of Washington. And so I tried to apply what I had learned from him to, you know, daily news production. And so from the beginning, I was trying to apply some of the techniques that I had learned that made things sound a little different and more emotional. But it took me a while to figure out how to do that. Like I wasn't very good at doing that for years. I would say it wasn't until I was in my late 20s that I kind of figured out how to take the lessons that I had learned and apply them to being a reporter. And truthfully, in a lot of reporting, there wasn't a lot of place for it. But in the places where there was, I could. The places where it applied is that when I was a daily reporter for NPR before doing this job, I was very conscious of doing characters and scenes and funny moments and emotional moments in stories, and also just having things in stories that were just there to amuse me. Even if it was a breaking news story, there would be little beats and moments that were there to amuse me, which I think you know, a lot of NPR's best reporters do. And not even just the best ones, like a lot of just the, you know, the ambitious ones do.
Those gems that you'd stick in there.
Yeah, just like little things you notice that you think, like, that'll be funny to put into a story. And especially things, I think it's especially nice when you're doing a serious story and a breaking news story and something funny happens, or there's a funny piece of tape, or somebody says something funny. It's like it's helpful to the storytelling. And it's also very different than most news coverage. Like most news coverage, there's a kind of strict segregation of the serious and the funny. And I think one of the reasons why people turn to public radio is because there's a feeling that you'll get something more alive, even in the breaking news stories.
Does this man know he kind of started this whole genre?
He knows he started me, for sure. His name is Keith Talbot. It's funny, he had a funny career after that. There's a bunch of people at public radio who he really brought in and helped and really established in public radio. Like, I don't think I'd be working in radio if it weren't for him. And then he went on to New York, to WNYC, and produced a kids show, a daily call-in kids show called Kids America that probably nobody remembers other than those of us who worked on it. And then after that, he got hired by Disney to restart the Mouseketeers. And so his employees were Justin Timberlake and Britney Spears and Ryan Gosling and all the people who went on to become super famous, who got their start on the Mouseketeers show. He moved to Florida.
This kind of ties into my next question of, what do you think of the fact that when public radio newsrooms like ours interview young reporters and ask the question, what's your favorite public radio show and why? This is for a job interview. They inevitably say This American Life or Ira Glass because of the storytelling.
I mean, what do I think?
I don't know if you even knew that.
I mean, I didn't know that. I mean, I think we're doing a style of story that sounds like it'd be fun to make. You know what I mean? and I feel like I was attracted to making these kinds of stories because it seemed like they'd be fun to make too. So I can understand, I have the same impulse. So I guess I understand why somebody wanting to do journalism would want to do stories like we do. They're really fun stories to do. I feel like our show just happens to be the most visible example of these kinds of stories. You know, but there's people on the radio all the time who do these, and these predate our show and me working with the guy who taught me all this stuff. There's always been a strain of people doing these kinds of stories in public radio. There's the Kitchen Sisters and Joe Richmond and Jay Allison, and there's like a whole. There's a whole little tribe of people who like these kinds of stories and been putting them on the air since the 70s. But because This American Life is just such a visible example of it, I feel like, people notice us. There's a producer named David Isay who does story booth stories. And before that did longer documentaries. And I feel like probably once every 6 months, somebody tells me about some story of mine that they really loved that was actually his. And I think it's just because This American Life is such a visible example of people trying to do, a certain kind of storytelling.
Our guest is Ira Glass, host and executive producer of This American Life. He brings his one-man show to Barbara B. Mann Hall in Fort Myers April 14th. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. You gave a commencement speech in December. What was your advice to the graduates?
My advice was amuse yourself. And I thought that was important because I think especially when you're in school learning the basics of journalism, everybody's very worried about, you learning to get the facts right and to, just work out the mechanics of your job. That I don't think very often, teachers are telling you, be sure you have fun. And I think the more that in any kind of work, probably, but certainly in journalism, the more that you're out to amuse yourself, the more memorable the work will be. And that's both true kind of in the micro execution of it. So just recently, like one of our producers, Ben Calhoun, did this story where we had gotten a tip that a pig processing plant was taking pig rectum and selling it for use as imitation calamari. In other words, they would the buyer would take this tube of rectum and slice it and then deep fry it and batter it and sell it as calamari, as imitation calamari. And we heard that and we're just like, can that be really be true? And then he did this piece where he just runs down that rumor with such glee at every stage. And people on the phone yelling at him and, you know, just like, and I feel like his joy in running down the story is what makes this story work. So that's kind of like on the fun scale of it, on the one side of it, it's turned out to be a really funny story and a really memorable story. But you know, on the other side, like some of the most popular things we've ever done really came out of just somebody on staff just getting curious about something and then taking the time to follow through. Like a couple of years ago, in 2008, before the financial crisis really kicked in, one of our producers just got very interested in this thing that was happening in Florida and everywhere else in the country of banks lending money to people without looking for proof that they could pay it back. There was a kind of standard loan product called a NINA loan, a no income, no asset loan, which is just crazy when you think about it, like no income. And you could just kind of get it anywhere. It was just kind of a standard thing you could buy in any state. And what it was they wouldn't look for proof that you had a job or that you had other assets. There was just an assumption the housing market will always continue to increase in value. And so it doesn't matter if you have a job. We'll just take the house back and resell it. And he became very interested in why were banks doing things that they hadn't done since the history of capitalism, like making sure people would pay back the loans, and which led him to learn about the fact that these loans, the banks weren't holding on to the loans. They didn't care if they were paid back because they were just going to take the loans as soon as they were made, and they were going to sell them up the chain to people who were bundling together mortgages into these mortgage-backed securities, which then, of course, you know, ended up bringing down the economy. And did an hour-long show that we called The Giant Pool of Money, where we meet all the people who basically brought down our economy by giving out these loans. And where he asked them, like, what did you think was going to happen? You know what I mean? Like, these incredibly risky loans to people who couldn't pay them back. Like, why did you participate in this? Like, how did this happen? And I feel like when we put that on the air, it was so early in – it was before Lehman Brothers collapsed. It was in the spring of 2008. Lehman Brothers and the real recession didn't kick into the fall. And I feel like it was one of those things where it was information that I think when people heard it – I certainly know I felt this way. Suddenly it explained what was happening around me in the economy exactly at the moment that it was happening. Like, I had never heard of mortgage-backed securities or any of these things, like most people. And that whole project, actually, that whole story ended up leading to us starting with NPR News, this project called Planet Money, which now does stories for NPR and for us. And I feel like all that just came out of, like, you know, one of our producers just kind of amusing himself and being like, well, what's interesting to me?
Why did you say in an interview that you wished Mitt Romney had targeted This American Life rather than Big Bird in the debates?
Publicity. You can't buy that kind of publicity. You know, like, we're a normal public radio show, so we don't set aside any money for advertising. And, you know, you just can't buy that kind of publicity. I invite any Republican legislator who wants to cut the funding of public broadcasting. I invite you, please name us. Please name us. And my campaign contribution is forthcoming. You know, but the fact is, like, sadly, I think that no one ever would name us because we don't get any federal money. Like, our show doesn't get any federal money. You know, like the federal money, in fact, makes up a very...
That didn't stop them before.
That didn't stop them before. Yeah, exactly. Well, I think, I don't know if Big Bird... It's funny now that you say this. I don't know if Big Bird gets any federal money.
Yeah, I don't know how TV works, but NPR doesn't get any and it didn't stop them, so...
Yeah, exactly. Don't you feel like we should say here for anyone listening that, like, only a tiny portion of public radio's money comes from the federal government? It's like 6 or 7% nationally.
It goes to stations, and stations pay the networks. And, you know, that's how it works. We're speaking with This American Life's Ira Glass. You can comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. He'll be in Fort Myers April 14th at Barbara B. Mann Hall. Since retracting the show titled Mr. Daisy and the Apple Factory, what has This American Life done to guard against fabrication and plagiarism?
We hired fact checkers. Before Mike Daisy, maybe I should say for people who don't even know what we're talking about, I saw this one-man show that this performer named Mike Daisy did, and it was kind of a big hit, this show that he was performing. And what it was he would go on stage and he would tell the story about how he loves Apple computers and got curious about how they were made and flew himself to Shenzhen, China, which is where the plants are that make a lot of the iPads and iPhones and computers that Apple sells, and then describes what he learned standing outside the factory gates and then touring through some factories, and which he presents as a work of nonfiction, and sort of was adamant about that. And it was really moving and really interesting to hear him tell the story of it. And so I thought, like, well, this would be good for radio if it's true. And so I met with him and kind of asked him, you know, if he wanted to put something on the radio, but said, like, you know, like, we're going to fact check it. And we did fact check it, actually, as far as we could go. And the one thing that we weren't able to fact check was he said he didn't have a way to get in contact with his translator that he used in China. And, you know, he said, look, here's the cell phone number I have for her, but I've tried it and, you know, it doesn't connect. And, you know, she's somebody in another continent. He said, like, she's somebody who he met at his hotel and got set up with. And so it didn't occur to us, like, in retrospect, it was not the right thing to do. Like, it was kind of a stupid mistake to think we couldn't track down this lady. In retrospect, we obviously could have. But it's for some reason we just assume, like, well, if he doesn't know how to reach her, I guess there's no way to reach her. And so we checked out everything else in his story, and everything else seemed to check out. And basically most of the things that he was reporting about Apple had been reported by other people, you know, real reporters who had gone in. And there were one or two things that he said that didn't check out. And we also talked to human rights groups, which do surveys of workers about conditions in Apple plants in China, or the plants that make Apple products. Apple doesn't actually own the plants. Everything checked out, you know, with one or two exceptions that we named on the radio. Like when we put his original story on the radio, we said, look, we checked into all this. You know, we probably talked to a dozen people who are familiar with the practices inside these plants. Everything checks out except for these one or two things. And in the original show, I kind of bring those up with him, like, well, are you sure you really saw this? Blah, blah, blah. And it went out on the radio. And then a reporter for Marketplace thought, like, well, this doesn't sound right, some of these details. And he found the translator. He found her very, very quickly and learned from the translator that although many of the things that Mike Daisy says are true, he did not witness them. He did not witness the things that he says he witnessed. And then some of the things, you know, that didn't seem like they matched up with other people who had reported, she said were just fabricated. In particular, child labor. Mike Daisy said he saw teenagers going into work at young teenagers going into work at these plants, which human rights groups, you know, you have a lot of criticisms or had a lot of criticisms at the time of Apple, said, you know, like, this isn't a problem at plants that Apple is manufacturing at. If anything, Apple was the opposite. It was a company that was doing it. They said everything possible to see that there was not child labor at these plants, and in fact had a very, very good record. And Apple itself published yearly surveys where they said, here's how many people we caught, you know, trying to work at these plants who weren't of age. And we're being very transparent about it. But Mike Daisy insisted, no, there was child labor. And so basically what we learned was that a lot of the story was untrue. And so we went on and did a second episode where we basically ran through the whole thing and retracted the first episode, and then ran through the truth of what we really knew. And then at the end of the episode kind of reviewed, okay, so here's what we do know still about what happens inside Apple plants. Up until that point, we had done fact-checking in the way that daily news shows on public radio do, and that really that daily journalism does everywhere. You know, like when you work at a newspaper, or on any kind of daily journalistic product, there isn't a team of fact checkers who go behind your reporting just because there isn't time. It would basically involve re-reporting the entire story. And usually, you know, for most breaking news, you know, you're turning around the whole story in, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours anyway. So there would just not be time to do it. But I grew up literally like working at the daily news shows, All Things Considered and Morning Edition. So the way that you would fact check is basically an editor and a reporter would go over anything that seems like it might be questionable and really review in detail like why the reporter thinks something is true and sometimes go back and get a second source on something, you know, double check something. And we were careful about that. And I have to say, we were especially careful in the Mike Daisy show. I mean, we spent 2 weeks aggressively, you know, running down every lead we could to see what was true. But since the Mike Daisy episode, basically, now we hire professional fact checkers. We set aside a lot of money, tens of thousands of dollars, and we fact check the way that a magazine does, like a big national magazine does, like the way the New Yorker does or the New York Times magazine. In fact, a number of the fact checkers who we hire, you know, had worked at the New York Times magazine. And so everything goes through this now very labor-intensive process of a second person going through everything and going through every source and calling back the sources to be sure that things are true and finding other sources to corroborate. So it's really changed what we do around here. I'm glad we're doing it, and I feel like we really have no choice. Like, I feel like I just don't want that to happen again. Can I say one interesting thing that happened as a result of the publicity with Mike Daisy? I feel like there was a combination of things that happened a year ago, January, which is that the New York Times came out with this huge series about the labor practices at Apple's plants in Shenzhen, China. And we broadcast Mike Daisy's original story, and then we broadcast the retraction episode too. And then other people started reporting on it as well. And it's interesting, the Times just did a story a couple of weeks ago where they've tracked how Apple has completely changed its labor practices in China to see that workers are treated better. And all of that effort began around that time. And it's hard not to feel like, I don't want to say Mike Daisy's report, but certainly the New York Times reporting. And then I feel like the Mike Daisy thing just kind of, I think, just was just, you know, icing on the cake.
There's some truth enough to it that...
Yeah, exactly. That the executives at Apple, you know, lots of them are public radio listeners. I I'm told that lots of people just felt like, oh, we gotta deal with this now. Like, you know, people starting to pay attention. I have been told, but can't totally verify.
Our guest is Ira Glass, host and executive producer of This American Life. He brings his one-man show to Barbara B. Mann Hall in Fort Myers April 14th. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. How is the series based on the story Midlife Cowboy coming along?
It's coming along beautifully. I mean, there was a script and HBO asked for some changes, and the changes have happened, and now we're waiting to hear if they're going to go and shoot a pilot. We have about a half dozen stories from the radio show that are in development to become either movies or TV shows. And so that's one of them, yeah.
You didn't seem to want to do the Showtime series when first approached back in 2002, but it seemed like despite the extra hard work, and it worked out, and since then these other stories have been made into pictures, including the Warner Brothers Unaccompanied Minors, the Midlife Cowboy, and...
Yeah, this last year we released a feature, Sleepwalk With Me, yeah.
So apparently... Have you signed this deal with DreamWorks? Is that true for more movies adapted from the show?
That was true at one time, but basically we had a deal with Warner Brothers to do that, and the film Unaccompanied Minors came out of that. And then we got the same deal basically with DreamWorks. But once we signed with DreamWorks, then DreamWorks went through a kind of transition where they stopped making small films. And so at the end of, I can't remember if it was a year or 2 years, we kind of shook hands with them and they said, you know, we just don't make films this small anymore. And so, you know, good luck to you. And they were super nice. Like the people at DreamWorks were always very, very smart and really nice people to work with. But, you know, we just had no product for them.
But you're now kind of cultivating projects?
So the projects that are happening now, we're basically just doing as independent producers, and we team up with various people. And so with each project, there's sort of a different producing partner or, you know, director or writer or whatever. You know, we like Sleepwalk With Me, you know, we didn't do it with a studio at all. Like we went out and raised the money with Mike Birbiglia and just produced the film.
So it's sort of turned around from this squeamish, I don't want to do pictures out of radio to we're pursuing it.
Well, actually, it's gone further. It's like the nitrogen cycle. It's gone from a squeamish, we don't want to do it, to I'm pursuing it, to I'm not sure I want to do it anymore. Yeah, I feel like now that we made Sleepwalk With Me, I was very, very involved in it for years. Like, you know, it took 2 years to get the script into shape. And I was very involved in that process, and then was there on the set, and then there in the editing room, and then there all through the marketing of it. It's very, very time consuming. And I'm not sure I want to spend that much time away from the radio show. Like, it was fun to do. It was really interesting to watch a movie get made. You know, like, I think anybody who's seen movies is like, it's cool to watch it happen. But no, I've done that. I don't know. Like, I'm not, I feel protective of the time that I'd like to be spending on the radio show, and don't want to be spending that much time away.
We're speaking with This American Life's Ira Glass. You can comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. He'll be in Fort Myers April 14th at Barbara B. Mann Hall. And so if you weren't doing This American Life, what would you be doing?
Honestly, I don't know. Like it's not like I have like a lot of other skills. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like every venture that I take into television or movies or some other medium convinces me of what a great deal we have on the radio. And I don't know. Like the radio show is at this point now where the staff is so experienced, and it seems like there's continually new things to invent and try. I don't know. I don't think about doing something else, is the truth. Like, things are going well. The one project, actually, that we've talked about is the idea of spinning off a second radio show.
Which would be?
It would be, we've done this thing now twice where the theme of the show has just been the week that just passed. So in other words, instead of taking the normal kind of theme we do in our show, we basically turn our show into a news program. Though a news program in the style of our program. So the stories have more emphasis on characters and funny beats and emotional beats. And also we define the news differently than a news program does, where we both will do the breaking news events in those episodes. So, you know, tornadoes. And the first time we tried this, it was the week that Osama bin Laden was killed. Like, we cover those things. But then in addition, we do the thing which we do in our show, which is we apply the tools of journalism to very personal stories. So the first time we did this, you know, one of the stories was a guy trying to speak Spanish that he had been like learning by CD for the very first time, or an 8-year-old riding a bike for the first time. Like, you know, just like documenting super small things that journalism would never pay any attention to, these very small moments, in addition to these big moments that had happened in the previous week. And so we've done it twice. The first time, I think it was a little more successful than the second. And we're going to do it again because we're trying to learn, okay, if this were to be a weekly show, how would you produce it? How big a staff would you need? You know, how would you work it as a weekly product? With the thought that if it went well, then we would spin it off. Is the silence that I'm hearing from you just incredulity at what a bad idea this sounds like?
No, I'm just wondering. Well, in the interim, where does it air, and how do you?
I mean, if people want to hear it, like it's we do it on our show. Like it's funny. Like, I had this idea for a long time. Because our show, we were doing more and more news. Like, we would do, you know, the financial crisis or the war on terror or Guantanamo. And, you know, and I just thought, like, at some point I just realized, like, I thought, like, well, somebody could do a news show in the style of our show. And it would be very different than what the news is. And somebody should do that. And I kept trying to talk friends into doing it. And at one point, in fact, like, even tried to talk somebody who does TV into, like, you should do this on TV. Like, this would be, like, an entertaining TV show, I think. And I kept trying to pitch people. And then I realized, like, oh, wait, we have a show. We could just do it on our show, you know, a couple times and see if it works. And so that's led to these experiments where we do it as episodes of our show. And if people are curious, they can go to our website, thisamericanlife.org, and type in This Week, the episodes we called them This Week. The first one is much, much better than the second one. So the first one was in May of 2011 and really gives you hope of, like, oh, this could be great. And then the second one, you feel like this feeling that I remember from when I worked on All Things Considered, which is like, we did a very professional job of that, but it would have been nice if it had been better.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Yeah, glad to. Nice job.
And we look forward to seeing you on stage.
Nice talking to you. Okay, bye-bye.
Ira Glass spoke to us from his home in New York. He's the host and executive producer of This American Life. Information about his performance in Fort Myers on April 14th is at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. We'll be back in a moment as John Davis explores this year's record-setting tourist season on World Tourism Day. I'm Amy Tardiff. You're listening to WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.